Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Pan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Tracy Weber. She is the owner and founder of Whole Life Yoga. Tracy is also the author of the award-winning Downward Dog Mystery Series. Tracy and I will be discussing how yoga became a $27 billion industry with more than 20 million practitioners. We will also be talking about her latest release, A Killer Retreat. Good morning, Tracy. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm wonderful. And thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. A Killer Retreat is a very exciting and entertaining read. The book has a wonderful touch of humor while addressing human relationship, which is really cool. By the way, I've always enjoyed and been fascinated with the practice of yoga, and especially the Western embrace of this discipline. So congratulations on both points and your accomplishments.
Thank you, Johnny. Do you practice yoga? Have you tried it?
Yes, I've tried it a little bit. I'm one of those yoga wannabe.
Well, maybe I can convince you to becoming a yoga is or a yoga whatever by the
right,
end of the conversation.
Right. I'm not as flexible as I like to, but I'm flexible enough for the things that I'm doing. I'm a ballroom dancer and instructor, so I enjoy that very much.
Wow. And yoga is also about flexibility of the mind. So yoga is more
right.
a teaching. I mean, certainly the bodies are benefited mm-hmm. from it, but it was actually designed to be a teaching of the mind. So if I can coerce you in a little more, say with your work, building more flexibility in your mind is more important than more flexibility in your body.
That's true. So true. So let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Montana on a dairy farm. I've actually had a sort of a weird circuitous path to getting to where I am right now. I grew up on a dairy farm, and I loved animals and just, you know, had a sort of a really nice childhood of living out in the country a little bit. And then I moved to Seattle to become a chemical engineer, of all things. And I worked as a chemical engineer out in Seattle. Once I moved to Seattle, I took root. I love the Pacific Northwest, which is one of the reasons why I've set my series here. I firmly believe in writing what you love, and I love Seattle and some of the other places in the Pacific Northwest. And so I moved here when I was 18 to come to college and just took root and never left again. And I worked as a chemical engineer for Weyerhaeuser out in Federal Way, which I was out here in Seattle for a number of years, and realized that I actually liked the work that I did with people more than the work I did that was engineering. And so I went back to school and got a master's in business, and I focused on leadership and team-based organizations and worked as what's called an organizational development consultant for a number of years and at both Weyerhaeuser and out on my own, and then realized that I liked being members of teams more than coaching teams. So I ended up at Microsoft and as a manager at Microsoft and was there for several years. And then I worked, after I left there, I helped manage for a brief time a nonprofit career development organization and studied to become a personal coach.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked as a personal coach for a while. When I was in my late 20s, I was in a car wreck and hurt my neck, so I couldn't turn it for a couple of years. I'll tell you more about that later. That's part of my yoga
mm-hmm.
journey. But I got introduced to yoga and became really intrigued by how yoga was changing my life and that whole desire to have my life really make a difference in people's lives started pulling at me again. So I left Microsoft in 2000 and opened my yoga studio, Whole Life Yoga, and have been teaching yoga and teaching other teachers how to teach yoga ever since.
Mm-hmm.
But about 3 years ago, my brain started wandering again, and I just had this delightful idea of wanting to try to write a book. And So I started to do that, and now I'm trying to juggle all of it, still living in the city I love, trying to juggle all of that. I live with my husband, Mark, and we've been together, I believe, 17 years. I should probably know that, but I'd have to calculate. He was actually the one of my good friends in college. When I moved to Seattle, he was the very first man that I actually met when I was moving into my dorm. So I joke that I moved to Seattle and married the first man I met. But we dated for 12 years before we actually got married. And so I live with we were friends for actually 12 years. But I live with him, and the love of my life is a dog named Tasha, and she's a German Shepherd, very much like Bella in the series. I live with Mark and Tasha, and my cat Maggie, and we're having a great time here.
Fantastic. You're obviously, I would consider as a type A personality, a go-getter, doing a little bit of this, doing a little bit of that, always on the cutting edge, I would say. And yet there's a certain amount of serenity in your voice in terms of what you are a person on the inside. So what life's epiphanies led you to your health and spiritual journey that culminated to what you are doing right now?
Yeah, you know, the one thing I've learned in my life so far is that whatever I believe is usually wrong. And so the fact, yeah, and honestly, it's like the stronger I think something is not right, the more I really need to look at it. And I've always been type A, so that piece is there.
Okay.
And I really didn't believe in anything very woo-woo. I'm still not a woo-woo person, but I really didn't believe in anything woo-woo. So I also happen to be vegetarian, and I always thought vegetarians were a little weird until I became one. And then I always thought yoga was this kind of weird practice that people who were Gumby-shaped woo-woo people did, and that I would never do it. And I honestly believed I couldn't do it. It wasn't just that I believed that I wouldn't do it. It was also I believed that I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And as I said earlier, when I was in my late 20s, I was in a car accident. And the car accident left me relatively severely injured. You couldn't see it from the outside, but I couldn't turn my head for 7 years. And I was put on a permanent weightlifting restriction of 10 pounds maximum. And I was in severe enough pain every day that I couldn't do things like unload the dishwasher. And I still worked, but there was just this sort of constant level of pain that would sort of ebb and flow throughout the day every day. And so I finally I tried every way of getting out of this pain. And at one point, I remember telling my now husband, we weren't married at the time, that I would fly to Africa and dance naked around a witch doctor's fire if I thought it would have helped, because you just get so desperate. And the thing I wanted to do even less than that was yoga. But I ended up trying a yoga class. And by the time that I got there, so it was 7 years after my original injury, by the time I stumbled into the yoga class, I was also a mid-level senior manager at Microsoft. And so the level of stress in my life was tremendous. And I stumbled into that first yoga class, and it was not the style that I eventually chose to teach or the style that I practice. And the style didn't really fit my injured body very well. But I walked into that yoga class, and when I walked out, my body actually felt worse because it wasn't a good match for me, but I felt really calm. And I remember going home that night to my husband, and the first thing I said was, honey, I've discovered what the word yoga means. And he said, what? And I said, much pain. yeah, I know, right? Which it shouldn't. But what I found was that when I practiced, even though I was in more pain when I practiced, this style of yoga, that I felt calmer and I felt better. And for me at that time in my life, because pain was already a constant presence, having less emotional pain and more emotional balance was a really good trade-off for me. And so I kept doing it. And the teacher I was taking yoga from moved away, or didn't move away, she went on a one-month vacation, and I tried taking a few other yoga classes while she was gone, and I didn't even know that a style called Vinny Yoga existed, which is the style that I teach. But I took the Vinny Yoga class, and for the first time, I walked out of yoga class feeling better both physically and mentally. And over the next about a year, nothing in life, if you have something that happens that is long-term and chronic in nature, the fix isn't instant either. But over about a year, I suddenly realized that I could turn my head again. And I realized that I was not in pain every day anymore. I still have flare-ups, but I'm so much better than I was. And so all these things that the medical professionals have said you're just going to have to live with as a sort of your life went away. And I was a better person. And I was calmer and happier. And so I just really got to thinking, and I honestly didn't think that I could teach yoga because I still have a body that's somewhat broken. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to my yoga teacher at the time and sort of stammering and stuttering and saying, do you think maybe for very, very beginners I might ever be able to lead a yoga class? Do you think that's even possible? And she looked at me and she said, you would be a fantastic instructor. And so then I started looking at teacher training programs in my lineage, and I was so drawn to do this. And in fact, the sort of spiritual epiphany, if you will, happened in a yoga class. I took a yoga class from that same teacher on New Year's Day morning. And she, one of the meditation questions she asked at the end was, what do you want to create in the coming year? Mm-hmm. And the answer came to me as clear as day, and it was, create a space for healing and growth. And what that meant to me was to build a yoga studio. So I drove home, and I walked in the door to my husband. I said, honey, I've decided I'm leaving my job at Microsoft and opening a yoga studio. We're going to be very broke. And because yoga doesn't make much money. And he said, okay. And I started the countdown clock to when I could do it, and I opened my yoga studio. So I started yoga teacher training so that I could actually teach at the yoga studio I was opening. Mm-hmm. The rest is sort of history. And it's been, if you listen to my winding, torturous path, which is mainly a path of continuing to find things that interest me in my career, yoga is the only profession I've stuck with for more than 5 years. And I've been with it now 14. Yeah, and so there's a level of challenge to it. But I think the big thing for yoga with me is that I'm still not woo-woo, and you don't have to be woo-woo. But the ancient teachings and the tools help you be a better person. And, you know, and so I really believe in that, and I really believe in sharing that with other people and trying to broaden that reach with other yoga teachers, by training other yoga teachers.
Right.
So that was a long answer to your question, but it was a long path.
It's a wonderful answer, because what I hear is you were on your journey of finding the authentic you. Through experiencing certain life challenges, as a natural type A personality, you usually brush things off and just go on with what you need to do. But through life experiences, you were able to find the humbleness from within, and then letting your heart speak to you in a different way, and then realizing the synergy of these three elements that helps you to create the harmony that you're actually looking for.
Right. That's well said.
So, congratulations.
Thank you.
By the way, I do have to tell you this, though. I'm glad we're doing this interview, because you're a vegan and I'm a meat eater. I don't eat vegetables.
You don't eat any vegetables at all?
No.
All right, so here's concession time, because I'm a vegetarian for ethical reasons, just because I've always been an animal nut. And how people choose to eat is a very personal thing. But I recently went to a doctor for sort of my normal health checkup, and I got chastised. I may be the only vegetarian on the planet that was chastised by her doctor for not eating enough vegetables.
Really?
Yeah, because I was eating, you know, she's like, well, what do you have for lunch? And so this is the embarrassment of the yoga teacher thing. What do you have for lunch? Frozen pizza rolls? What do you have for dinner? whatever I can find. So I've started making smoothies now, so that I'll actually get enough vegetables in my diet. So I have the distinction of being a vegetarian that doesn't eat enough vegetables.
You may have to get one of those ninja things that they advertise on TV and dump all the vegetables in it and start drinking
it that way. That's what I got. I got a Vitamix, and I really love it. I'm not a Vitamix. I don't sell Vitamixes, but it's actually helped, and I'm actually getting more fruits and vegetables.
Interesting. How is the practice of yoga different in the Western world compared to its origin in the East?
Yeah. It's sort of sad. My teacher, I studied with Gary Craftsow at the American Vinny Yoga Institute, and my teacher tells a joke, which unfortunately is, you know, many things that are humorous are somewhat close to the truth, and so it's that irony that makes them funny. But he calls it the reductionism of yoga in America, and so hopefully I'm not going to insult anybody because it's really meant to be funny. But it also hides the truth a little bit, is that yoga in India was always designed to be a whole human system practice that incorporated a variety of tools, which included asana, which are the poses, and included meditation, and included chant, and included ritual, and included breath work. And all of these tools combined together were really about creating space in the mind to find what you're talking about being your authentic self. And at the same time, it was this wonderful tool for promoting whole body health and longevity. And then it got brought to America. And unfortunately, when it got brought to America, the primary tool is what people see when they look on the cover of Yoga Journal, which the primary tool that got brought to America was asana. And so we tend to, in America, think about asana as the sort of primary, as yoga. So yoga is a pose. Yoga is the movements. And then he said, but then it got even worse because even asana, if you look at the tool of asana in yoga, that's a really wide practice that involves bringing balance to the joints and ligaments, that involves bringing both strength and flexibility, that involves, in someone who's ultra-flexible, maybe even actually trying to strengthen and decrease their flexibility to have greater integration and health and strength in their body. But that got reduced, too, so that yoga was all about stretching. So when if you ask the typical male, if they want to try yoga, they say, I'm not flexible enough. And honestly, that when I was thinking about yoga, I said, I can't do yoga, I'm not flexible enough. Mm-hmm. So we've started to think about yoga then as a tool for flexibility. And then he said, but then it got even worse because yoga can be about flexibility all throughout your whole body and flexibility in your mind, if you will. But because of the way some lineages have sort of interpreted yoga's tools, they do everything with straight legs and locked knees, so it's all about stretching your hamstrings. So he says yoga in America is stretching your hamstrings. And so it's sort of sad that yoga in the West has lost a little bit of its breadth. So in losing some of its breadth, it has diminished some of its benefits and has prevented so many people, like I was, from even giving it a try because they don't realize that yoga is for every single body and that yoga is for every single belief system and yoga is for every single age. Because the tools that we have can be adapted to everybody, the applicability and the ability to bring greater health and greater peace of mind is just huge. And so I'm a little bit sad that that has gotten lost in the translation to the West. And I'm doing what I can to try to reach out to people who think they can't do yoga. I'm still meeting them where they are. So at my studio, it's still mainly movement classes. But if you go to my teacher trainings, you definitely learn a broader subset of tools that are so powerful, people can't believe it. And they can be very applicable to the West. And so it's a little sad to me that that in some ways it's become more of an exercise. People really think of it as something to add to your exercise routine. And it is good exercise, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. So it's a little bit sad. And it's also a little bit sad to me. It's great that yoga is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and it's sad that we have so many, like you have to have your yoga pants, and you have to have your, in India, they don't even practice on mats. And you know, I've even seen yoga shoes, and yoga's supposed to be practiced barefoot. So now I see yoga shoes, and I'm like, what do you need? And there's shoes that you wear to the yoga studio and then take off to practice yoga. And so being Americans, we're very much about productizing.
Yeah.
And all of that sort of makes me a little bit sad. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that yoga has been popularized in the West. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was declining in popularity in India. When I worked at Microsoft, I worked with many Indian nationals. And when they learned I was leaving Microsoft to start a yoga studio, the Indian nationals would often tell me, yoga, that's something my parents did. So the popularization of yoga in America has actually re-brought interest back into India.
Right.
And so it's, you know, and so there's probably a lot more people practicing because of how we do it. And I think now our goal is, now that we've got, you know, we've sort of enticed Americans to try yoga, what we need to do is to really make sure that that hopefully we bring in more of the additional benefits that yoga really has to offer.
So true. I think the most important misconception that people have about yoga is the fact that, right off the bat, for people that really don't know what that discipline is, look at it as sort of a ritual religious practice.
Yeah.
And so by definition, that is a turn off in a way, as they understand that this is more than that. I believe that the pioneers, the yoga individuals that brought this to the Western world in so many ways, as they expand the concept of, you know, wait a minute now, you can do these practices, this exercise, this body discipline, and incorporate in what your spiritual beliefs are,
that
in a way expanded the concept of mind, body, and spirit.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's the other barrier that many people have to trying yoga, is the fear that they're doing something that is against their religion, that contradicts their spiritual teachings. And if you look at the primary text of yoga is actually called the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, and it was written somewhere around 200 BC and 400 AD. And so people think that yoga is Hinduism, but in reality, it's not. The Yoga Sutras were a secular text, and in fact, because the Yoga Sutras talk about a concept called Ishvara, and Ishvara is basically the word is God with a small g, and it is sort of what gives you joy and purpose, and what is beyond you that gives you passion and that helps you to be the best person that you can be. And they don't say any specific deity. And because the Yoga Sutras did not say a specific deity, the Hindu religion rejected it when it was written.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a separate path from Hinduism. Now, that doesn't mean certainly the culture that yoga was birthed in is both Buddhist and Hindu, for sure, just like the culture that birthed Pilates. We're a multicultural, multi-religious country, but we have a Christian base. So you could say Pilates is Christian. Well, they're different things.
Right.
And yoga is not Hinduism. And I think that studios that are sort of operating to the masses do a little bit of a mistake when they have statues of Hindu gods in their studios and chant to Hindu gods, because we don't need to do that. And really, yoga is a way of connecting with whatever spiritual belief system you have. And so I've had teachers that graduate from my program that teach in Christian churches.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people who graduate from my teacher training program who are atheists. And everything, and I've had pastors, Christian pastors, take my training. And to the extent that we can make yoga accessible to everybody by stripping away all the stuff that we put on top of it and just letting people connect to whatever gives them joy and purpose, that's how we can really make it sort of accessible to everyone. And so there's so much fear around yoga based in people who believe that it's Hindu. And I grew up Christian, and fortunately my father, who was very Christian, was very supportive, as was the pastor of our church, in my doing this. But I really wish people would break the sort of link between yoga and Hinduism, unless they're Hindu and want to have yoga support their Hinduism. Because it really is so much broader than that. You know, we tend to narrow things, and we just need to take off all those labels we put on and broaden.
So true. What are some of the benefits of practicing yoga?
Oh, gosh, there are so many of them. So the sutras, again, which are sort of the ancient text of yoga, define the purpose of yoga as clarifying the mind. And so what I'll say that the people usually try yoga because something like me, because they want something in their body. Something's either broken that they want to heal, or they want to gain flexibility, or they want a good workout, or they want to sweat, or all these different sort of physical reasons draw us to yoga. The people who really stay with it stay because they find something much more profound. And so the sort of number one most important benefit of yoga is this clarity of mind and the reduction of stress and sort of the ability to unearth and live by your value system. And I think that's really sort of finding that quiet place within. They talk about having the three filters of the mind, the clear quartz crystal, the smoky quartz crystal, and the rosy quartz crystal, and that people who see through the rosy quartz crystal see everything sort of better than it is, which can lead to dissatisfaction down the line. People with the smoky quartz crystal see things as worse than it is. But the goal is to develop a clear crystal so we experience life exactly as it is without all our filters and triggers and traumas and all those kinds of things. So that when I'm with my family, I'm not the 13-year-old adolescent anymore. I'm actually me now. Does that make sense?
Yes.
But beyond that, yoga has these wonderful gifts for the body. And yoga can not only improve your flexibility, it can improve your strength. It decreases pain. It can help with issues from heart disease to asthma to depression to anxiety to low back pain. I've used yoga tools to help people rehab from knee replacement surgery. I've used yoga tools to help. I had a man who kept going into heart arrhythmias so that he'd have to go in an ambulance to the hospital and get his heart shocked. And I worked with yoga tools with him. I never claimed that I would stop that I would be able to fix that arrhythmia. But in using really gentle yoga and some meditation, by the time I stopped working him, he hadn't had to go to the hospital in a very long time. And so these yoga tools, basically what I say is if you have a condition that is worsened by stress, it can be helped with yoga. Because what yoga does is, you know, the body has all these responses to stress and anxiety. And so yoga sort of helped reset that. And so it's truly this sort of whole body practice that can help on so very many, many, many levels. And for me personally, what it did was it decreased my pain, it decreased my stress, it made me less reactive in the world. I already had a great exercise program. I've always been somewhat of an exercise addict, so I didn't need more cardio. I didn't need more, you know, sort of the normal stuff. So my yoga practice for me was always about balancing all the rest of the stuff that I did. And that's also what I'd say is, you know, weekend warriors and triathletes and people that are out there, gardeners, knitters, all these people that are doing their passions and their loves, whatever they are our loves. Anything we do repetitively over time brings up stress in the body. And yoga can help balance that stress, so that you can continue to do those things you love, horseback riding, whatever it is.
Yeah,
it can
yeah.
balance all of those repetitive stresses so that you can continue to do those pain-free for the rest of your life.
Very interesting. Where do you see the practice of yoga heading by the year 2020?
I don't know the answer to that, but I have hopes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it's an interesting time to be in yoga because we've got all these things like Groupons and things that are making yoga really sort of inexpensive to try, which is nice but is also tough because it's hard to it's harder for studios to sort of build and maintain a following. So it's sort of an interesting, I think that there's, and I don't know about the rest of the country so much, but Seattle, basically on every corner you can find a Starbucks and a yoga studio. That's a joke. It was obviously. if you were in Seattle, all the Seattle people were really laughing because there's Starbucks everywhere and yoga studios everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I think that's going to happen in the places where there may be an overabundance of yoga is that that we're going to see a little bit of a contraction in the market. And so by 2020, I don't know if this will have happened yet, but what I do think is going to happen, and I certainly see it in my own studio, is that hopefully more people are going to be reaching out to yoga for things other than flexibility, like more health benefits. So we're starting to certify, we not me, but we the nation, are starting to certify more yoga therapists, people who work with yoga tools to help heal as complementary medicine, help heal conditions. And I think more and more people are going to start reaching out for that. There's so many things that Western medicine simply doesn't address well. And yoga isn't a substitute for any healthcare system, it's an adjunct to it. But things like, we don't understand chronic pain very well. All of these chronic autoimmune diseases that are showing up, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, multiple sclerosis, all of these different sort of syndromes that are showing up that we don't know how to really help and heal, yoga tends to work really well for a lot of those. In managing symptoms and back pain, where we can actually be pretty curative. There have been some good studies coming out on that. And so I think to be accepted by Western medicine, everything needs to be double-blind, placebo-controlled trials. And yoga coming from India, their way of research has always been single case study. And so the West has been a little bit reluctant to accept yoga as a healthcare addition because of the lack of studies. And those studies are starting now. And so as those studies are showing benefits of yoga, the more doctors are going to be referring patients to yoga, and it's going to become more integrated as a very real, helpful piece of overall health. And so I'm hoping that we'll see more of people seeking out yoga for its therapeutic benefits in addition to its fitness. Now, by 2020, I don't know that we'll be there yet. But I am seeing that start, and certainly that's been a huge focus of my work in my yoga studio, and there definitely is demand for that. The other thing I think that's going to happen is that we're going to see a lot more yoga taught to aging populations. There's, you know, the huge baby boomer thing, but also a lot of them are more open to it now. So there's a lot of demand for teaching yoga at senior centers and in aging facilities, going and teaching chair yoga classes. And so I think that the baby boomers are also going to be driving more yoga that's more adaptable, because as we age, we need yoga that's more adaptable. And
right.
So I sort of hope that continues to balance the trend, which now seems to be, and I say this with all due respect, really strong, hot yoga, where you go in, sweat, get a workout, and leave. And I don't want to denigrate that, but what I'd like to do is balance that. And that's, I sort of see that as a huge growth opportunity.
Very interesting prediction. Coming back to your writing endeavors.
Yes.
When did you discover you have a talent for writing?
I always knew that I could write well. I was just very slow at it. And by always, I guess when I got my first degree, I always I'm getting a chemical engineering degree, but I took a whole lot of extra classes in liberal arts because I really liked liberal arts. So I ended up taking 5 years to get my degree, and I had 5 years of credits just because I took so many classes that didn't count toward my degree. And I got good feedback when I would write. I got really good feedback from my professors. So I always knew that I had an ability to write, but I was super slow at it, and I figured if I ever tried to write something like a, you know, because I was writing short things then. If I ever tried to write anything like a book, you know, it would take me until I died. And I also believed, interestingly enough, that I didn't have it in me. And by didn't have it in me, what I meant was the fortitude and the patience, because it takes, when you're just starting out as a writer, you don't know that anyone's ever going to buy and publish your book. And so you're working and you're living this thing, and it can take well over a year to write a novel. And so you have to have that patience to keep at it without knowing at all what the endpoint's going to be, if anyone's ever going to read it other than you. And I have in my life lived next door to two really prolific authors. And I remember my next door neighbor's name is Boyd Morrison, and he's a thriller writer. And if you ever get a chance to read his work, you should pick it up. But I had dinner with him one night, probably about 3.5 years ago. And I said, I do not know how you do that. How you could, I could never write a book. And then I don't know. So you know, like I said, whenever I say I won't do something, I should just start doing it because everything I say is wrong. I was then fast forward not very darn far, and I was riding an exercise bike, and what I do to distract myself from exercising is read. I was reading a book by a woman named Susan Conant, and I love her work. She's a mystery writer, and she writes what's called the Dog Lovers Mysteries. And my husband calls me the creepy puppy lady. I'm really into dogs. I love dogs. And she had this quote about crazy dog people, and it just hit me so funny. And she had just, it was like I found my soulmate. This woman knew me as the creepy dog lady. And so I jumped off the exercise bike and I ran home and I wanted to learn more about her and her work. And I stumbled across this site called CozyMystery.com, and I was reading it and reading this genre that I didn't even know existed, although I had read it a lot. I didn't realize it was its own genre. And the genre is about people who aren't police officers or detectives who sort of get involved in solving crime. And they're usually pretty lighthearted. And I was reading and I thought, I should do this. And it was kind of like create a place of healing and growth. Something was right, like write a yoga mystery. And I started thinking, you know, what would happen if a yoga teacher started stumbling across dead bodies? And it seems ridiculous, but it's not, because yoga teachers live in the real world. And so what if that happened? And then I sort of filed it in my don't be a fool, Tracy, just go on with your life. But the idea wouldn't go away. And this character of Kate, who's the character that I write about, popped into my head, and she just refused to leave. And she just insisted that I write down her story. And so to shut her up, I thought I would tell a few people that I wanted to do this so that they would tell me it was stupid. And so I told a few people about it, and they all loved the idea. And so finally I just said, fine, and I procrastinated for about a year, and then I took a writer's conference and went to a writer's conference, and that inspired me, and I wrote the first draft of that first novel in 3 weeks. And that I just have wanted to do it ever since. And that first novel was my first book, which is Murder Strikes a Pose. And it took a lot longer than 3 weeks to write because my first draft was pretty bad. But the first draft, getting it out of me, was pretty easy. And so, you know, there was just that spark point. And it was sort of that same idea that something just comes in your head. And even though you believe it's silly, it just doesn't want to go away. And so, you know, and then did I know that I could write then? Probably not. So the first time I actually realized that I am a reasonable writer, there are so many great writers out there. I'm a reasonable writer was when people that didn't know me started emailing me and telling me they loved my work. And that was probably when I really felt validated, because your friends and your mom and those kind of people, they have to say they like your work because they love you. and you know, they probably like it because they see you in it. And if they love you, they love your work. But people who didn't know me starting to email and say that my work had touched them, or that they really love my stories and they can't wait till the next one, that's sort of when I really felt it.
Right. So true. Do you daydream a whole lot?
All the time. and that has been true for me since as long as I can remember. I have always been a daydreamer. And I've sort of always concocted stories in my head. I just never wrote them down until now. And so I remember even as a child, I would have these daydreams. And the daydreams, when I would fall asleep at night, I would be sort of creating stories in my daydreams, and then that story would continue to build. And so I would not write, but I would think whole plot lines for characters and stories in my head ever since I was a child. And I just thought that's what everybody did. So, and maybe it is what everybody does. I don't know. But
yeah,
I do daydream a lot. And especially now, as I meet people, I create stories in my head around them, that, you know, fictional, knowing that they're fictional.
Right.
But it is something that I do. And the daydreaming piece of it is also what's allowed me, I think, to be more open to changing careers throughout my whole life, was that I was always, when I reach a point of dissatisfaction, if you will, I'm always sort of daydreaming about what the future could be and how the future could be different. And so it's sort of a gift that God, the universe, or, you know, the sutras or whatever has given me, is the fact that I can use imagination in sort of a constructive way, because imagination can also go the other direction too, in a very destructive way. But yeah, I'm a daydreamer.
Interesting. So what makes a good mystery story?
You know, if you ask about 30 different mystery writers that question, you'll get 35 different answers. For me, because the genre I write in is the genre I love, which is cozy mysteries. And cozy mysteries are lighthearted, blood and gore is minimized, sex is behind closed doors. They tend to be. So it's the kind of thing, if your 8-year-old kid picks up the book, you're not going to run and grab it from their hand. But the other piece to cozies, and this is true in other mysteries that are series mysteries often, is that the crime, although it takes center stage, it's also, the series is about watching the characters around it and their lives and their work and their hobbies and getting to know them a little bit better. So for me, a good mystery not only has to have sort of a crime that you care about. So if someone's killed and you don't care, then why bother, right? So you either have to care about it because you want to know who hurt this person because that person didn't deserve to be hurt, or you have to care about it because maybe the person deserved to be, you know, in your own mind, like, yeah, okay, so that person was killed, I don't really care. But someone else has to be harmed by that. So someone has to be accused who you like and you don't want to have done it. And there have to be sort of the liberal clues sort of sprinkled throughout, and you have to not know who did it right away so that you can sort of be puzzling along as you go. But beyond that, I have to care about the characters, and I have to care about the struggles that they're facing, and I have to feel a connection in some way to the characters, that they're real and that they struggle like all the rest of us. And so there's sort of a piece that when you're a cozy fan and you invest in a series, you really, it's not just that you enjoy the work, but you sort of begin to think of these characters as real people that are a part of your life, and you root for them and you get mad at them when they do stupid things. And so there's that piece of really wanting to, not just in one book, but over an arc of many books, really invest in getting to know these characters and rooting for them and celebrating their successes. And so there's that piece to it too. And I also like mysteries that, without being heavy-handed, nobody really cares what the author's opinions are on societal ills, but that talks about real things and real issues that make you think about things differently. And so far in my books, there's always been some sort of real issue that was also at the heart of the book that makes people sort of think too. And so that piece I like as well. And even though it's fiction, good fiction authors research like the devil to make their work authentic to the truth. And so it's also, I think that good mysteries also paint a very realistic picture and may pique your interest in learning more about something that you didn't know about.
So true. Very interesting. Give us a synopsis of A Killer Retreat. The book is just released last week, correct?
Yes, it was released last Thursday. A Killer Retreat involves, so my whole series, the protagonist of my series is Kate Davidson, and she's a Seattle-based yoga teacher, and she has it's a solid relationship, but she's commitment phobic. She says she has commitment ADD. So, but she has a boyfriend, and she has a crazy German shepherd named Bella. And Michael and Kate and Bella go to a retreat center on Orcas Island called Elysian Springs, and they are going there so Kate can teach yoga at a facility. At the facility there, and Kate unfortunately also has an anger management problem, and she gets into a scuffle with one of the people at the retreat, who happens to also be the mother-in-law of Emmy, who's the owner of the retreat, and they get into a scuffle and an argument, not a physical scuffle, but an argument, and Kate, because she can't keep her mouth shut, threatens to kill her. And then when the next day the body of that same character is found floating face down in the hot tub, Kate ends up being accused and arrested for the crime. And her best friend Renee shows up on the scene, sort of hiding a secret from Renee and from her husband. And so Kate is sort of trying to solve a couple of mysteries while she does this. One is who actually killed Monica so that she doesn't end up in prison in teaching what she calls death row yoga. And also trying to solve the mystery of what's going on with her friend so that she can help her friend, because something's very definitely wrong with her friend. And then her dog gets sick, and so it's this whole sort of cascade of events that all take place within one weekend, while Kate is also trying to teach yoga to yoga guests who also think she might be a murder suspect. So they're not all that excited about doing stress reduction yoga with a murderer. So there's a lot of sort of fun and humor in it. But it all revolves around trying to figure out who killed this actually quite nasty woman named Monica.
I really love the book. I think it's very entertaining, and like you say, it's fun, it's quick moving, and it's lighthearted in so many ways. So it talks about human relationships and so forth, so I thought you did a fantastic job with that, weaving it into the book, a murder mystery with the yoga and so forth. I thought it was just wonderful.
Thank you.
How did you go about in choosing the various characters? That's something that's quite interesting, because you have certain things revolve around certain people and so forth. So let's talk about that.
They choose me. I don't describe it any different. Yeah, you know, and I always worry a little bit about saying these things out loud, because somebody's going to eventually commit me.
That's me, but in the book.
Yeah, I have my little invisible friends that I talk to and write them down. But it's really interesting, because people who know me and who read the work, they're always sort of trying to figure out who I'm writing about. In my first book, there was a really nasty landlord of the yoga studio who had a beard. And now when people come to my yoga studio, they're all looking for the nasty landlord with the beard. I'm like, he doesn't exist. It's fiction, you guys. But it's interesting, and I'm also what's called a pantser. So writers either do detailed outlines or they write by the seat of their pants, and I'm a pantser, because these stories sort of reveal themselves to me as they come, and then I go back and make sure that I've played fair with the reader and planted clues and things. But these characters sort of show up, and and they change. So I might start, like, I'll make an outline of who they are, and then I'm halfway into the book and they go, no, that's not me. That's not even what I look like. So then I have to go back and revise. But they sort of just come to me. And the one I've been trying to figure out where he came from is Dale, who's the goat lawyer. I have never met anybody like Dale, and he is such a great guy, so I kind of want to meet him. But you know, that character of this goat rescuing ex-attorney who pretends to be Southern-born when he's really – he is Southern-born, but pretends to be sort of a good old boy when he's really very sharp. This character, I don't know where he came from, but he became crystal clear to me, and I just knew who he was. And so it's just very interesting. It's a very – for me, writing is, in many ways, a revelatory process in that things are revealed to me, and then I write them down. It's kind of fun, because it's like I'm always, you know, out there at a party looking for new friends.
How much of you is in the book?
Probably more than I'd ever care to admit. you know, I always say, so this is always my party line, if you will, that I am not if you read my books, I'm not the neurotic yoga teacher. I'm the cool best friend. That's not really true. But you know, I have to say that, you know, in order for me to birth these characters, there has to be a part of me in every single one of them. There just has to be, or they couldn't come from me. And I will say that I have built my series on the foundation of my life. By that I mean that I'm a yoga teacher who lives with a crazy German Shepherd dog who has EPI, which is the digestive disease that Kate's dog has, who owns a yoga studio in Seattle. And my protagonist is a yoga teacher who lives with a crazy German Shepherd dog who owns a yoga studio in Seattle. And so the framework is there. I believe in writing what you love. And so the framework of what I love about my life is definitely the framework of the book. And Kate and I share some superficial characteristics. So we both have body image issues, even though we really shouldn't, because we're both sort of normal body weight. And we're both 5'3", and or I'm 5'2". I actually gave Kate an extra inch on me just so that she could feel better about herself. And we both really truly believe in yoga, even though we're not the sort of prototypical yoga teacher. But I don't have an anger management issue like Kate has, and I've never had commitment phobia like Kate has. And you know, Kate has pagonophobia too, which is the fear of beards, and I don't have any problem with beards at all. So bearded men keep coming up to me and apologizing that they creep me out so much. And I'm like, guys, it's fiction. My own mother, by the way, when she read my first book, said, "I'm just at the part where you found the body." And I'm like, "Mom, I haven't found any bodies." So people, there's enough of me in sort of Kate's humor, I think, that people really see me when they read Kate. But Kate and I, we have different neuroses and different issues. The dog is very much, although I've on purpose designed some differences in the two dogs, but the dog is very much my dog, and the connection of the character with the dog is very much my connection with my dog. So I'd say that there are pieces of sort of the framework and the love and connection of the human and animal. And when you read a really funny story about something stupid that happens to Kate because of the dog, those are usually real things. So in a killer retreat where Kate falls on her head behind the bed because she pulls it out so that the dog can be underneath it, I actually fell on my head behind a bed on Orcas Island for that very same reason. In the first book where Bella drags Kate down a hill and Kate almost falls into water, but she stops from drowning by landing headfirst into a tree, that really happened. So there's a lot of sort of funny dog quirky stories that are in there that were my what I call my Tasha stories that I've been regaling everyone with for years. But yet Kate has a totally different backstory than me. She has a totally different upbringing. She has much different demons. So you know, I guess the piece is that there's a lot of me in my books, but there's also a lot that isn't me that sort of makes Kate more interesting than me. Let's say it that way.
What I'm envisioning is this. You know how it's comical where if you're angry or you're upset and you say, "Excuse me for a minute, okay?" And then you go into your private office or go outside and you start yelling, "Ah!" Okay?
Right.
In your situation, it would be like, "Okay, guys, excuse me for a minute. I got to go into the bedroom." And then you start pulling, "Chapter one." I got to.
Exactly. So the story on a killer retreat, I went to Orcas Island for a retreat, for a vacation with my husband one time, and the scene of the dog sort of running circles around Bella in a killer retreat. Actually, there was a woman who had an off-leash dog, different dog, but that was harassing my poor dog, and so my story is I wanted to kill her, so I did. So I wrote this whole book. So yeah, you're right. Excuse me, and I give actually coffee mugs away to people that I love that say, "Be careful or you'll wind up in my novel."
Very interesting. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading A Killer Retreat?
The first reason a writer writes is to try to entertain people. So I just hope that they have a really good time reading the book and that it helps sort of carry them away from the day-to-day of their life and helps immerse them in a new place. The other thing I think, couple more things, is one is that this digestive disease that the dog has, EPI, is a relatively rare disease and lifelong but very manageable. And so many animals that have this disease are sort of needlessly euthanized when they could live complete, perfect, happy, normal lives. And so part of me is about spreading a little bit of information about this disease and just showing a dog thriving with it. And then the third, you know, you talk about relationships. And so part of what I want to sort of tease without being heavy-handed is just that this idea of growth in relationships and this idea of how we get in our own way. So Kate gets in her own way so much on so many levels, and she certainly in this book is totally getting in her own way and at risk of destroying her relationship, and that relationship is extremely important to her, and she's at risk of destroying it, number one, because of unfounded fears, and number two, because she's afraid of actually confronting it. So she's not sharing her fears. She's just trying to disappear to avoid facing these fears. And so there's also this piece, you know, the Yoga Sutras again, talk about what are called sources of suffering, and one of the sources of suffering is ignorance, and another is aversion. And Kate, in this most of this book, Kate is living in the land of ignorance and aversion. She's ignorant. She doesn't know what the future is going to bring. She's ignorant about that, and so she's avoiding the truth. And when you live in these dark places of ignorance and aversion, only, like, you know, mold grows in darkness, fungus grows in darkness, flowers and plant life grows in light. And so sort of showing people, and, you know, and in many ways, that's the same thing in the second book that's happening with Renee, is Renee is also in aversion land and fear. And so watching these two sort of otherwise very intelligent women living in fear and how that's causing so much drama and problem for them that doesn't need to exist, and sort of showing people how even through the struggles of relationship, that we can find ourselves and we can find light, and that through that communication, good things generally happen. And if bad things happen, they're still the right things that are meant to happen. And so there's sort of that theme in the book as well.
So interesting. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Yeah, so to find out about me, I've got an author website, Tracy Weber, T-R-A-C-Y, Weber, W-E-B-E-R, author.com. And if you go to that website, you'll have the ability to send me an email. You'll have the ability to join my newsletter. You'll have the ability to friend me on Facebook. One of the things that I truly love about writing has been meeting new people and connecting both with other writers and with people who read my work. And so, don't at all be shy about sending me a message on Facebook or emailing me, because it makes my day. My work, both of my books, Murder Strikes Suppose and A Killer Retreat, can be found at pretty much any bookstore. And if your favorite bookstore doesn't have it, you can ask them to order it for you. And then those of you who are online impulse buyers like I often am, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Kobo as well. So pretty much anywhere you would expect to find any other book, you can find mine.
Wonderful. What is next for you?
In terms of my yoga teaching, I'm going to keep on keeping on. I'm still teaching, and I'm about to graduate an advanced training, and then I'm starting another 200-hour level in February. And I've already written book 3 in the series, which is tentatively titled Karma's a Killer. And that one will release next January, but it's already been written and turned in to my publisher. And now I'm working on proposals for books 4 and 5 in the series. So, and keeping my fingers crossed and hoping against all hope, because my first contract was for 3 books, I'm hoping and against all hope that this book does well enough that my publisher wants to continue with 4 and 5.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
I'm stealing my recipe. My recipe came from, it's often attributed to Ralph Waldo Emerson, but it's live well, laugh often, and love much.
That's very interesting. That's wonderful. It's just direct, precise, to the point. It's exactly what I expect from a type A personality like you. To the point and direct. So that's wonderful. Tracy, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Kalyani. She is a New Age world music recording artist. Her debut single, Namu's Invocation, was featured last year in the world premiere of a new independent film, A Winter Rose, at the Dances with Film Festival at the Hollywood Chinese Theater. Her debut album is scheduled for release later this spring. Kalyani and I will be discussing her spiritual inspired music and her mission to inspire and transform humanity through her empowering music. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Tracy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day and an awesome 2015.
Thank you. You too. It was wonderful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.